Hi, this is Alan Chartok, and I'm really excited to be back in conversation with Dr. Timothy Snyder, the Levin Professor of History at Yale University and a permanent fellow at the Institute for Human Sciences in Vienna. Professor Snyder is one of America's leading historians and public intellectuals. Last time he was here, Professor Snyder talked about his book on tyranny, 20 Lessons from the 20th Century. Today, he joins us to talk about his new book, The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America. Welcome back, Professor Timothy Snyder.
Very glad to be here.
Well, we're glad you're here, too, and I must say, based on our last conversation, so are an awful lot of other people. Okay, so the book is The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America. I found your writing on Russia to be just fascinating. So let's start with Russia. I'm going to say a word, and I want you to respond to it, okay?
Sure.
Russia.
So Russia's not a foreign country. How about that? There are two schools of thought about Russia in the U.S. now. There are people who say, we shouldn't be paying so much attention to Russia because we've got our own problems. And then there are people who say, no, we should be paying an awful lot of attention to Russia because they interfered with and probably determined the outcome of our presidential election. And in this one, everybody's right. The point of the book is that we have to understand Russia in order to understand ourselves, because Russia as an oligarchy with extreme inequality of wealth and income points to a certain outcome that America is trending towards and which we want to try to prevent. But we also have to understand Russia because Russia has a certain style of politics which is catching, which is contagious. And now we come to the arc of the book, or the story of the book. What Russia has been doing in the last few years has been deliberately trying to spread its version of politics from them to us. They don't have any grand vision of how they want the world to look, but they do have the notion that rule of law states in Europe and America are a threat to Russia, and therefore we're going to try to bring those things down, make those things look more like us. And they've enjoyed an awful lot of success in that, especially in this country, and that's one of the reasons I wrote the book.
Professor Tim Snyder, how do they do that? I mean, in other words, what's the technique? We know what's been alleged, but what is their way of doing it?
Mm-hmm. Let me start with alleged. One of the reasons why it's very important as an American not to always look at the world from America is that you miss important things. So this whole question about whether Russia carries out cyber war to affect other countries' domestic politics has been settled for a decade. The only thing which keeps us from seeing it is our American exceptionalism. We think, well, for some reason, I'm not clear on this reason, but for some reason, what happens other places can't happen to us. But Russia's been interfering in other countries' domestic politics with cyber for more than a decade, and with increasing success. Unfortunately, the greatest success was in the United States. And so in the book, I try to show how this has evolved from Estonia in 2007, through Ukraine, through the European Union, to us. Now, how does it work? Well, here, a particular history of Russia and the Soviet Union is helpful. What's happened is that the world has changed in such a way that traditional Russian techniques of influence work better. The Russians were always better, much better than we were, at what are called active measures. That is, attempts to use the other side's own commitments and interests and preoccupations and vulnerabilities against it, to try to get the other side to do something which is not in its own interest. For example, let's say you're the Soviet Union in right at the beginning of its existence. You run something called Operation Trust. And what you do is you send out agents who tell Western powers that the Soviet Union is about to collapse anyway. And that's what people in the West want to hear. And the idea is to prevent them from actually having an active anti-Soviet policy. I'm giving you an actual example from the beginning of the Soviet Union. So it's very inexpensive. It works on the psychological vulnerabilities of the other side, what they want to hear, and that's how it works for you. So the Soviets were doing that kind of thing for decades and with some success. What's changed in the 21st century is not so much Russia. They're doing the same thing they always did. It's that we've given them this huge new attack surface, which is called the internet. The internet allows people who want to practice active measures to go directly into your mind by way of your computer screen and your eyes. And I don't think we quite understood just how significant this was. So Russia's kind of stayed the same, but by the 2010s, most Americans were spending a huge amount of time in front of the internet. And this meant that there was this new channel through which to try to push people's buttons, to get them excited, to get them indignant, and to get them to do things in the end that are against their own interests, like, for example, voting for Mr. Trump.
So can you give me any specifics of how they have used the internet? We've been reading a lot of stuff, but what is false about what they're putting out there, and what is their aim?
Well, I mean, there's an awful lot to say about that. I can only give you a few examples.
Fine.
There are several distinct techniques. So we all remember that Russia hacked the accounts of important democratic politicians and important democratic institutions, which meant that in the 2016 presidential election, the Democratic Party, whatever one thinks of it, was operating in a completely different psychological environment than the Republican Party, because Democratic activists had all of their private data out in public, and their donors did as well, which created a completely different atmosphere than the Republicans faced. And then that leak of emails, or that hacking of emails, can then be connected with another technique, which is a swarm of social bots or political bots on Twitter to help their candidate Trump at a crucial moment. This is a second example. When the Access Hollywood tape broke, it looked for about half an hour like the Trump campaign was over. But after half an hour, Russian bots and trolls worked very hard to release the emails of John Podesta and then to spin stories, crazy stories about Hillary Clinton and Podesta, you know, being a pedophile and having these weird sex orgies and so on. And that crowded up the story. It meant that the people who were supposed to be indignant about Trump's sexual behavior weren't, because they were being fed all of this false stuff about the other side. Third major example, probably the most important example, is targeted social media, especially Facebook. You learn what people are vulnerable to, and then you target messages, whether it's about race, whether it's about Islam, whether it's about guns, to people, either to get them to demotivate them to vote for Secretary Clinton or to motivate them to vote for Mr. Trump. So all of that was going on and so much more. What are they trying to do? I mean, there are three levels of motivation. The first is personal. One of the things I write about in the book is Mr. Putin's very specific animus towards Secretary Clinton. Another one of them is domestic. Fundamentally, you don't want the United States or the European Union to exist as thriving, prosperous, big entities with the rule of law. If you're Mr. Putin, what you're trying to do is show your own population that that's not possible, that that's not real, that that's all fake. And then fundamentally, your goal in foreign policy is what I call in the book a kind of strategic relativism. It's not that you're trying to do anything in particular. You don't have a great vision like communists once did. It's that you're just trying to persuade everybody in the European Union and in America that facts aren't real. There's not really truth out there. All that matters is our emotions, our passions, and inflame our passions against one another so that we're dysfunctional. So we all think our own system is a joke, and so our system stops being able to do things.
So Trump is the president of the United States now, so we have to assume they knew what they were doing.
Well, I mean, their relationship with Trump is much more profound than even the cyber techniques. The cyber techniques are just the end of the story. Mr. Trump doesn't exist in the American mind at all if he doesn't play a successful businessman on TV, which is itself an important point, because playing a successful businessman on TV is not the same thing as actually being a successful businessman. I know a lot of successful businessmen, and not a single one of them could actually play a successful businessman on TV. But my point here is that Mr. Trump only exists in the American public mind because Russia financially props him up in the 1990s and the 2000s. Even the pretense that he's some kind of successful businessman is not possible without the various ways in which Russia or Russians financed him in the 90s and the 2000s. So it's not just about late 2016 and social media. It's about something which clearly has a much longer pedigree, has a much longer genealogy. And yes, I mean, your question is a good one. They knew Mr. Trump very well. Mr. Trump is what they want America to look like. They want America to be run by people who just care about money, you know, who don't have it and therefore are willing to make tremendous compromises to get it, people who don't really care about the rules. I mean, the whole logic of the marriage between Mr. Trump and Mr. Putin is that they both think that capitalism is a joke, that the rules are for other people, you know, the rules are for stupid people, for small people, that in the real world, the rules don't apply. And the real people are the big men who get outside the rules and operate in a world of offshores and anonymous companies and shell companies. That's part of our world. And that's the part of our world that people like Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump want to make bigger, want to expand.
Well, you know, you're a brilliant historian, and you spend a good deal of time in the book talking about some of the Russian past. How much does what happened during the Soviet time, or even before that, count to what they're doing now?
There's a really basic difference between history, you know, what happens and what we make of it, and memory, which is how we as individuals or politicals then use the past to justify our political or our personal decisions. In the case of Mr. Putin, what I try to describe in the book is something called the politics of eternity, where you use the past as a story to justify your ability to do whatever you like in the present. So when Mr. Putin orders the Russian army to invade Ukraine, as takes place in 2014 and 2015, he tells stories about the past. He talks about the conversion of an ancient Scandinavian prince 1,000 years before. He talks about Empress Catherine the Great in the 18th century. He talks about the Second World War. None of these things in any obvious way justify the invasion of a sovereign state by another sovereign state in the 21st century. But if you have a certain kind of politics, you can say, look, we were always innocent. We were always on the right side. History just loops over and over and over again. And what it shows is that the outsiders are coming for us. And so the way the Russian people were given the story of Ukraine is that this was an offensive by the European Union, by the United States. Russia was saving Ukraine from these hostile Western decadent forces and so on. So I put a lot of history into the book because I'm trying to explain how the politics of memory actually works. And history works against memory. I mean, if you put history out there, then what leaders say and do about the past usually seems, you know, it seems just like a justification of decisions they want to take on other grounds.
So you said before that Russia props up Trump. I mean, what is the nature of what we don't know about Trump yet? We have the kid coming out and saying we get all our money from the Russians and the rest. But what is it about Trump that makes him so attractive to them as an ally? And what is it about Hillary that made her such a devil to them?
Yeah. So, I mean, there's a certain amount of danger in putting too much weight on the personalities. So let me stress instead what Hillary Clinton represented to them. She represented three things. The first thing was that she was a woman, and Mr. Putin really has trouble with the idea that women are powerful. And when, for example, he's confronted with a Hillary Clinton or an Angela Merkel, he reacts in curious ways, which suggests, I think, a deep degree of personal discomfort. The second thing that Secretary Clinton represented as Secretary of State was American diplomacy. And the Russians really don't like American diplomats because they, I think, unlike us a lot of the time, understand that American power is spread not so much by our armed forces, but rather by our diplomats, whether you're thinking about American economic interests or whether you're thinking about human rights or democratization. It's the diplomats who actually do the work. They wanted an America without a serious diplomat in charge, and that's what they've got with Mr. Trump. We don't have serious diplomacy anymore, and our whole diplomatic corps has basically been decimated. The third thing that the Secretary Clinton stood for, which they don't like, is some kind of world order based on rules. And one can agree or disagree with, you know, particular things that Secretary Clinton stood for, stands for. But clearly, she was in favor of some kind of world order which had something to do with the rule of law. Her public utterances on that are pretty unambiguous. Mr. Trump is attractive because, number one, he's not a woman. He's a man who can be appealed to, you know, with things like a Miss Universe pageant that creates a common language for men like Trump and men like the Russian oligarchs he was dealing with when his Miss Universe pageant went to Russia in 2013. Number two, Mr. Trump doesn't care about rules or structures or diplomats or things like that. He wants everything to be a lot of macho individual posturing, you know, carried out by the big boys. And that's incredibly comfortable for Russia because compared to the people who run Russian politics, he's, you know, intellectually and diplomatically a child. He's easy to push around. And so it creates a very comfortable situation for Russia, which after all is a much smaller country economically than the U.S. If you can get a leader at the top of the state who doesn't have serious institutional support, and also has no serious intellectual background of his own, that creates an edge for you. And then the third thing which makes Mr. Trump attractive is, as I mentioned before, his belief in a world of no rules. The way that Russian oligarchy functions is that the people at the top of the Russian state, the ones who have stolen the Russian national wealth, use the black holes in world capitalism to hide their wealth. That's the kind of person Mr. Trump would like to be. He's not there yet. He doesn't seem to actually have any money, but that's the kind of person he would like to be. And it's that world, it's those black holes of capitalism that brought Mr. Trump and Russia together precisely. That's the genealogy of their relationship. It's Russian mobsters buying Mr. Trump's apartments in Trump Tower in the 1990s, which makes the first connection, apparently. And then when Mr. Trump needs money, it's anonymous shell companies buying units of Trump apartments during his campaign, which brings money to him and so on and so forth. So that's what makes him so attractive. And that's just leaving aside the fact that they're counting on Mr. Trump creating chaos inside the U.S. political system, which, of course, was a reasonable expectation.
The book is The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America, by Professor Timothy Snyder. It's so hot that it's being grabbed off the shelves. Tim, if I may call you that, I guess the next question here is, what about the Russian understanding? Do they understand American politics better than political scientists in this country understand it? Because of their knowledge of it, are they able to get over on it?
That's such a great question. Because on the one side, I mean, think about 2016. How many political scientists, economists, sociologists, opinion poll guys predicted that Trump was going to win? How many predicted that he was going to be even the Republican nominee? I mean, in general, we thought it was impossible he would be nominated. Then we thought he couldn't possibly win. And even statisticians were arguing that position, like right down to the night of the election, that there was no way that Mr. Trump could possibly win. You know, Nate Silver, who had, I forget what it was, but he said roughly a 30% chance that Trump would win. People were laughing at him and mocking him and saying, no, there's no way that it's as high as 30%. And then Mr. Trump won. Whereas on the other hand, my colleagues who are Russian journalists or Ukrainian journalists or people who follow East European politics in general saw in Trump a familiar figure. They saw in his constant lying and his appeal to the past a familiar political style, which they knew could succeed because they'd seen it elsewhere. And so interestingly, in my world at least, Russians and Ukrainians often thought that Mr. Trump could win and correctly predicted that he would in fact win. Now, how much does Russia know about us, the Russian state know about us? This is an interesting question because they're helpful, okay? They're kind of like, you know, your close friend who has a mean side and actually tells you what your faults are.
Yep.
That's what they are. So there are a lot of things about America that Russia doesn't understand or just doesn't believe in. But they do see our weaknesses, and they exploit those weaknesses. The way the cyber campaign is designed shows a certain knowledge of the institutional and social weaknesses of the U.S. It played on our racial problems. It played on gun violence. It also played on structural things like the Electoral College. They knew perfectly well which states they had to focus on in the last few weeks, and they focused on those states. And they use a lot of the same themes of fear of the other, which they tried out at home and also tried out in Europe before they came to us. So the whole idea of building the wall, right, that had been tried out in Europe before, that whole immigrant theme. When Mr. Trump focuses on rape, as he seems to do, that is a Russian propaganda trope, which they've used at home and which they've also tried to use in Europe as well. So Russia is like that friend who, you know, kind of slaps you and says, look, this is what's really going on in your society. And then you can choose to pay attention or not to pay attention. So I think the right way to respond to the Russian violation of our sovereignty is to say, all right, on the one hand, we have to make sure this doesn't happen again by securing our electoral infrastructure and by cleaning up the way the internet works in the U.S. But on the other hand, we should take this as an opportunity to note that, yes, indeed, there are major racial problems that have to be resolved. Yes, indeed, there are problems like massive wealth inequality, which Russian propaganda played on. And there's nothing that we can do about those at the level of cyber propaganda. Those are actual social problems, which we have to address with policy. And I think that's, you know, that's the only positive way that one can react to this whole incident is to say, look, we can learn a useful lesson, not just about cyber in Russia, but about the things that have to be improved in the United States.
Well, that's not going to happen as long as Trump's the president, right? I mean, it's a great observation that these are the things we have to fix, but here's the anti-fixer who's in the presidency.
Yeah, but I want to partially disagree with that because some of the things that need to be done are at the local and the state level. So, for example, in Delaware, you can register companies anonymously. So you have 200,000 companies registered at a single building, at a single address in Delaware. And that's the kind of thing which allows shell companies to interfere in our politics and generally to make a mess of how our economy works. Those are things which can be closed down at the state level. And there are some things that you could even deal with at the local level. So I think it's important to remember that politics is not only federal, but I mean, I want to make a bigger point here, too. I think it's very important for us to recognize that not everything was great in this country in 2016. You know, that it's not just Mr. Trump, that there were expanding problems. Wealth inequality, I think, is the central example that were growing in the whole last generation. And let's say the politics are different. Somebody else is president. You have to have some notion of what you want to do. right? You can't just say, well, everything was great, you know, except for the Russians and Trump, because that's not true. You have to have some kind of a positive agenda.
You spend an awful lot of time, Professor Tim Snyder, author of The Road to Unfreedom, and before that, the bestseller On Tyranny, you spend an awful lot of time talking about this concept of wealth inequality. I take it you believe that we're heading in the wrong direction. How do we turn this ocean liner around?
Yeah, that's so fundamental. And it's something which was brought home to me from two directions. The first is, if you look at Russia, you see how a system with extreme and basically unchangeable wealth inequality can function. And it's kind of a nightmare vision. You know, it's a vision where you know that the same people who control the money are going to be in power until they die. And there's something deeply depressing about that. And likewise, you see how they use these tricks that they applied on us, these propaganda tricks, thoroughly all the time at home to create a kind of alternative reality in which people live and die. And that's also just deeply, deeply depressing, a world of spectacle where you're told that you're innocent and that nothing is really better anywhere in the world. That's deeply depressing. It's an outcome that one doesn't want to see, you know, for one's own country or for one's children. And then from the other side, as I spent time, you know, in the Midwest, and I spent time in other parts of the country thinking about this book, as I spent the year between On Tyranny and this, traveling around the states and trying to think concretely about what wealth inequality does, from the other side, you see how wealth inequality makes ideas of progress basically impossible. I mean, if you're doing worse than your parents, or if you think your children are going to do worse than you, it's very hard to believe in a story that things are going to get better. And that creates a huge vulnerability, because then people can come along and say, well, government can't do anything ever. And you can say, yeah, I don't like government. And then you're basically sealing your own fate. And that's the political choice which faces the U.S. You know, as wealth inequality grows, are we going to say policy can't do anything? That's just the way things are, right? Which a lot of people want to say. Or, you know, to try to answer your question, are we going to address basic issues which have to do mainly with the family and with childhood, which will help people have a more equal experience? And those things have to do with maternity and paternity leave, with vacations, with public education, with pensions. Not that you have to give people so much money. The point is that you give people the basics that they need so that they can think they have a chance, so they think that things aren't stacked against them. There are basic measures, you know, which we don't have, which other countries with comparable levels of wealth do have. And the first step would be to put those things in place so Americans aren't so fearful and Americans can think, okay, when I look into the future, I see possibility and not just things turning against me.
So you're a Yale University professor. You have those students, best and the brightest. What do they make of all of this?
I'm sorry, Alan, I got to say something else about your previous question.
Yeah, of course.
Another thing we have to do is recognize that a lot of the economy has gotten out of control of the state.
Sure.
So we have to be able to bring the offshore economy back onshore. We can't have a world economy where big companies, but also rich individuals, can park their money in places where it can't be taxed, whereas normal middle-class people have to play by the normal rules. That's something we can't have. We have to recognize the power and the authority of the state to go after that wealth and to tax it in the name of fairness, but also in the name of financing the programs that everybody needs, also in the name of just having a nation, because you can't have a nation if some people are allowed to opt out and park their money and basically their existence elsewhere. So sorry, that was a very important, for me, that's a very important thing. Like, one of the blind spots of globalization is the way that money finds its way, you know, to the deepest, darkest black hole. And what you have to do is, you know, flash light on those black holes the way that the Panama Papers did, the Paradise Papers did. We know a fair amount about the situation now. We even know what laws we could pass. So that, for me, is also an important part of the story. So I'm sorry, about Yale students. I mean, the book is framed by ideas of time. And the reason it's framed in terms of time is that I started this book thinking about young people. I started both On Tyranny and Road to Unfreedom thinking about the next generation, thinking about history as something that we've kind of let fall. You know, we told ourselves that history was over, that there were no alternatives. And as a result, as a society, we've raised this millennial generation without a past, without history. So when 2016 happened, not only 2016, I felt this very strong impulse that we have to get this generation back into history in the sense of knowing something about the past, which is, of course, my day job, but also in the sense of feeling responsibility for the present, because the whole point of history and the point of this book is to get people to see where we are. And once you see where you are, then you have to take a certain amount of responsibility for what you can and can't do. So my students at Yale are kind of, some of them are extremely active politically. Some of them take much more radical and interesting positions than I do. I would say the general trend is they're kind of wading back into reality. Like step by step, they're moving towards seeing that the world didn't just have to go in a certain direction, that history is much more unpredictable than that, that individual action matters a lot more than maybe they thought it did.
I want to go back to Russia for a moment. We are in a great crisis in this country. We have a president of the United States who fires everybody at will. There's chaos in the White House. There's chaos in the government, in the cabinet. And we do know that this president has, from the very beginning, indicated that he didn't really have anything bad to say about the Russians. He kept saying that the Russians are our friends and that Putin's a good man and I don't believe any of this Russian stuff interference. It turns out, of course, that he was wrong. Nevertheless, do they, in your opinion, Professor Tim Snyder, do they own the guy?
I think he wants to be owned by them, which is slightly different. I mean, that's the depressing thing. The depressing thing is if you forget about America for a minute, which is an important part of the thought experiment because Mr. Trump doesn't care about America one way or the other. So forget about America for a minute and just think about Mr. Trump's personal trajectory. How has he lived his life? How has he run his affairs? Given the way he thinks about things, that laws don't really matter, they don't really apply to him, given his failure as a real estate developer in the 90s and the 2000s, Russia is a boon. I mean, from his point of view, the way he sees the world, Russia is like a generous father figure, which pulls him out of complete failure and threatening obscurity and allows him to become a public figure and allows him to become now an important politician, the president of the United States. So from Trump's point of view, Russia, or rather Putin personally, is the nice patron, right? And that's the second part of what I want to say. You know, what's really at stake here in U.S.-Russian relations and in the current political conflict in the U.S. is not about personalities. It's about how you think politics works. Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump are on the side which says the law is a joke. Mr. Mueller and a number of other people in the U.S. are on the side which says, no, we live in a rule of law state, and law is the basis of both our prosperity and our freedom and of any other and of any reforms that we might carry out in the future. Those are the real stakes. So I'm not going to speculate about like exactly what materials the Russians have on Mr. Trump. I don't think that's exactly it. I don't think that's essential, even if they have the most, you know, amazingly spectacular things. I don't actually think he's someone who's possible to shame very easily. But what I do think is that he is drawn to a world where it's all about a few guys backslapping with wealth and the rules being a joke and for the stupid people. And that's the world that Russia offers him. In that sense, yes, they own him. But the distressing thing is that he wants to be owned. He wants to be owned.
So does he get away with this? Because we as a country are, well, for want of a better word, either undereducated or stupid.
Well, I think he gets away with it partly because of our virtues and not just our vices. He gets away with it because we want to trust that people are something like what they say they are, which in many transactions is a perfectly reasonable assumption. He gets away with it because we want to believe in our democratic institutions, which is also good because they're not going to work if we don't believe in them. So in some sense, it's an exceptional situation. On the other side, I think the mistakes we made were first to imagine that America automatically is a democracy, whereas in fact, by our own devices, without the help of the Russians, we've taken a number of important steps away from democracy, especially decisions by the Supreme Court in the 2010s. And, you know, without any help from Russia, we've allowed wealth inequality to become a problem, which I think itself threatens democracy, because it's very hard to believe that you're an equal member of a society with somebody who has a billion times more resources than you do. You know, we're in a country where there are these spectacular billionaires doing spectacular things and where 100,000 people are evicted from their apartments every month and where roughly 20 veterans of our armed forces commit suicide every day. I mean, these are spectacular kinds of inequality, which make it very hard for people to think that they're living in the same world, right? So those are the kinds of things I think one has to get one's mind around.
So the name of the book is The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America, Timothy Snyder, distinguished professor at Yale. Tim, then the question becomes, what about the second subtitle, Europe? What role do they play in this?
Thank you for asking that, because one of the points of my book is that there is just one story, you know, the Russian story, the Ukraine story, the story of the disintegration or the threats to the European Union and the election of Donald Trump in 2016, it's all one story. And Europe is absolutely central to it. Europe's a middle chapter. And the reason for that is, although it's, you know, not natural for us to see this, the European Union is actually the biggest economy in the world. It's considerably bigger than ours. And the European Union is closer to Russia than we are. And so Russia's first foreign policy attempts to disrupt were not directed against us. They were directed against the European Union. And they start in 2013. That's why the European Union is in the middle of the book. From the point of view of Moscow, you know, there's a kind of near enemy, the EU, and there's a distant enemy, the US, and they both pose the same problem. They both seem to demonstrate that rule of law states can produce prosperous economies and free societies. You want to show that that's not true. And so we've already talked about Russia's done to us, but before Russia started doing those things to us, it was already at work in Europe, supporting the right-wing populist party, the Front National in France financially, supporting Brexit with propaganda and then with the cyber campaign, which I think was very significant, supporting extreme right politicians everywhere, and using its significant media as well as internet resources to try to spread doubt and fear about the European Union in the minds of the citizens of EU member states. That was all going on, and that's all part of the same story. And we've talked about American vulnerabilities. I've tried to make the case that it's our vulnerabilities and Russia's sense of our vulnerabilities which makes its cyber campaign effective. The same is true in Europe. In the book, I try to explain what European vulnerabilities are and how Russia has appealed to those vulnerabilities.
And what are they?
I call this the politics of inevitability in the book. We have our story of inevitability, which is that so long as you have the market, there's going to be a democracy and everything's going to be fine and, you know, there are no alternatives anyway. The European story is that European nation states are old and wise, and they've learned from the Second World War that war was a bad thing, and therefore they founded this project of integration called the European Union. And that's all balderdash. Actually, European nation states, as a general matter, never existed. There were European empires, and when those empires broke apart, the metropolitan part of the empire, the European part of the empire, then joined an integration project, which is now called the European Union. There's never a moment when there was a France or there was a Britain as such. So that creates a vulnerability. The vulnerability is that you think, oh, I can go back to the nation state when things are fine and we were just with our own people and there were no immigrants and so on and so forth. That never actually happened. There was never a nation state. You know, there were more Muslims in Britain or France in the 1930s than there are now for obvious reasons. The places were empires back then. But you can have that fantasy. And so what Russia does very ably is that it plays on that fantasy. It says, yes, let's go back to the good old days. Let's leave the European Union. Let's go back to being a virtuous, simple French nation state without Muslims. Let's go back to being a virtuous, simple Great Britain without Muslims and immigrants and so on. Its propaganda spins people in that direction, but it's spinning them in a direction that some of them were going already. And I mean, that brings me to one of the points of the book, which is the value of history. Part of the book with respect to both the US and Europe is to remind us what the 1930s were actually like, as opposed to our warm imagined remembrance of them. In the US, when we say America first, we're referring to the 1930s as though the 1930s were a good time. The 1930s were not a good time. When the Europeans imagine, oh, we could go back to a period before integration, that's the 1930s, which were an absolutely disastrous period. But you need history to work against the political memory, which the political memory tells you, oh, if we could just get away from all these other people, we could find this safe space, this national safe space, where we would just be with ourselves. That's never happened. It can't happen. The world has to be about integration. It's just a question of what forms you choose.
There are those people, Tim Snyder, who have been raising the specter of fascism, that Donald Trump is trying to lead us into a fascist government, a fascist country. Is that right?
Well, it's a tricky question to answer because it kind of forces one to talk about the things that fascists did that Mr. Trump is not able to do. And then it can sound like, you know, you're reciting the things that were good about the fascists. But one difference between Mr. Trump and the fascists of the 20s and 30s is that the fascists in the 20s and 30s were very energetic. And he's not, right? I mean, he's essentially a destroyer. He wants to be in bed with a cheeseburger by six. That's not how fascists actually experience life. Adolf Hitler had a spectacular memory for detail in his own way. He had read quite a lot. He knew how the German state worked, which made it easier for him to disassemble it and reassemble it. You can't really say that about Mr. Trump. So there are certainly these things that are specific to him, and they have to do with, I think, his desired lifestyle of being an oligarch who doesn't do a whole lot, but since the rules don't apply to him, he makes a great fortune anyway. What I think is true about Mr. Trump is that he uses certain fascist techniques, often word for word, certain pieces of fascist rhetoric, to try to change the country so it bends more towards his vision of it. We've already mentioned the example of America First. What was America First? It was basically a campaign to say we don't want immigrants, we don't want to fight a war against Nazi Germany, we don't want the welfare state, right? America First describes a very different country, one which would be, in today's terms, an extreme right country. Mr. Trump also does things that fascists did, like encourage violence at his public gatherings. You know, he encouraged people to beat other people. He encouraged not once but twice his supporters to shoot Hillary Clinton to death, which is very close to the way that fascists talk about their political opponents. And the fundamental thing I think that Mr. Trump does, which is like what fascists do, is he tries to reduce the world to us and them. He doesn't let us think about policy or what would be good for all of us. He's constantly trying to divide us up into tribes, where it's us against the Mexicans or the migrants or, you know, the blacks against the whites or whatever it might be. That's the way fascists approach politics. Politics is all about friend and enemy. It's not about agreement. It's not about policies that are good forever. Oh, and one more thing is the factuality. So Mr. Trump is very hostile to factuality, and that's something which he has in common with fascists. Fascists thought, you do away with the facts, you create a kind of myth of unity of the nation, and a myth that the nation is represented personally by one leader. I don't think that's something that Mr. Trump can quite carry off, but he certainly works in that direction. His scorn of factuality is probably the most consistent feature of his personality. Now, I don't think he's trying to get us towards a fascist state. I mean, frankly, I think that sounds like something which would require a lot of work from his point of view. But what I do think is that he's using certain fascist techniques to justify the United States becoming a country which is more lawless and more oligarchical. And that, in turn, is what he has in common with Mr. Putin. Mr. Putin has also revived fascist thinkers, fascist turns of phrase, not, I think, because he's actually trying to move Russia into becoming a fascist state, but because those techniques allow him to make politics more about emotions and more about spectacle, which is comfortable if your goal at the end of the day is just to die sitting on the national wealth.
Well, you know, when Hitler and Mussolini did it, it worked, certainly. So the distinction is these guys don't want a fascist state, but they are not above, if I'm hearing you correctly, they're not above using fascist techniques to feather their own nests.
Yeah, I mean, I meant what I said as a condemnation. You know, when I'm making these distinctions, I'm not trying to say that what Mr. Putin and Mr. Trump is doing is all right. I think it's anti-patriotic and nihilistic because it does a huge amount of damage to the nation, basically for the cause of making sure that in Mr. Trump's case, you can become a very wealthy Russian client, or in the case of Mr. Putin, that you can maintain the wealth of you and your clan. So it's not, you know, racial oligarchy is not a good thing. I just say it's not exactly the same thing as fascism in the 1930s.
Let's go back to Europe for a moment. I like Europe. So America has reacted to what Trump and Putin are trying to do. Is there a difference in the way that the European population, the people, are responding to the same stimuli?
It's a tricky question to answer because the way that Russian influence enters a conversation is by portraying itself as something else. So when people react to something, they're very often not aware what they're reacting to. So to take the example of Brexit, a big part of the conversation, the political conversation over Brexit, was actually guided by Russia. But literally zero people in Britain knew that at the time, or at least let's say the average electorate in Britain had no idea this was taking place. So they didn't know that they were supposed to react to something because they just didn't know it was there. And this was true in America in 2016 as well. I mean, part of the very effectiveness of the Russian operation was that very important people, especially on the Republican side, like Michael Flynn or Kellyanne Conway or Jack Posobiec, they are becoming channels of Russian propaganda. They're retweeting stuff which is entirely Russian invention. But they don't know it. Right? They like the stuff because it appeals to them, which it's meant to do, but they don't know that they're taking part in a Russian operation, or at least I take it they don't know it. Maybe they suspect it. So, you know, it's hard to answer the question, like, because the whole way that active measures work is something which already exists in your personality, personal or national, and they meld it and they move it in a certain way. Okay, now that said, there are a couple of things that are different in Europe than here. The Europeans don't have the exceptionalism that we have, so their debates tend to go a little bit faster than ours does. We spend a lot of time first clearing our throats about how it can't happen here. And that's not, you know, the Germans, for example, don't have to clear their throats about that. In European, you know, to stay with Germany, one thing which is interesting that the Germans have done is the major political parties have said, we're not going to use Twitter bots. We're not going to use bots in our campaigns. That seems to me to be like a useful step in the right direction. In France, you know, Macron has been much more forthright about what he thinks the Russians did against him during the campaign than obviously Mr. Trump has been in the United States. But, you know, do the Europeans in general get it more than the Americans do? Certainly, they realized that Russia was carrying out massive cyber war against democracy faster than we did. But on the other hand, it started there earlier than it started here. I guess what I would say is this is one big process where Mr. Trump, you know, in the United States is an outlier in his denials that this is happening. Pretty much everybody in Europe knows that this is happening. Even the Russians don't particularly deny it.
So I was listening to the Beeb this very morning as we speak, and there was some discussion as to whether mistakes, if I'm getting this right, that are being made here could lead to inadvertently to a world war.
You're going to have to clarify which mistakes we're talking about, Alan.
Well, the idea that this stuff is happening, the Russians are interfering with democracies around the world. They're getting caught up in that now. And we have seen wars start over less, like archdukes.
Well, I guess a lot depends. I mean, it's hard for me to answer the question because I think that war in the early 21st century is different than war in the early 20th. Mm-hmm. In the early 20th, you know, as you suggest with your reference to Franz Ferdinand, you have these, you know, basically quite modern, at least in military terms, very wealthy empires with the control land around the world facing off on the battlefields of Europe and expending huge wealth and killing millions of people. That's what war looked like 100 years ago. I don't think it's what war looks like today necessarily. So Clausewitz, you know, who was the great theorist of war, says that war is about bending the will of the enemy to your own will. And then a lot of what he writes about is about combat. But interestingly, you know, combat is always a means to an end. You can fight war without combat. And what happened to the United States in 2016, and it's very, you know, it's hard for us to face this, but I think it's better to face it than not, was that our will was bent. Something happened to us that would not have happened had it not been for foreign intervention.
Absolutely.
Mr. Trump would not have existed as a public figure, would not have been nominated by the Republicans, would not have won the election without the help of a foreign power. And that foreign power regards itself as carrying out a war against us. This is one of the things I document in the book, by the way. The book is a little bit different from other Russian books in that it starts from the Russian sources and from the Russian perspectives. And over and over and over again, you have Russians explaining what their military doctrine is, that information war is the most important kind of war, that, you know, traditional combat operations can be cover for an information war rather than the other way around. And you have Russians talking in 2016, you know, sometimes even openly about the war against the United States. So I mean, it's hard to answer the question because I think a war is already happening. It's already happened, and we've lost a very important first engagement. I think that's unfortunately the way to think about it. If Russia, you know, in some ways is like America, they don't want to lose thousands of troops in Iraq, you know, sorry, in Syria or in Ukraine or wherever else they're fighting. You know, they're like us. They would prefer to fight wars in different ways, and they've gotten ahead of us in thinking about how wars can be fought in other ways. So, I mean, I think a war is going on, and one has to, you know, like in all wars, you have to think about how you change your domestic politics as well as your warfighting practices if you don't want to keep losing battles. Now, is this all going to lead to some kind of third world war? One has to be careful with that because that's a Russian meme. I mean, the Russians talk over and over again about how if you do something they don't like, there's going to be World War III. That's just a big thing that they say all the time. If you elect Hillary Clinton, there'll be World War III. Intervene in Syria, there'll be World War III. You know, they just pull out World War III all the time. But they don't want World War III any more than anyone else does. So for me, the important thing is that whether we like it or not, you know, we are unfortunately in a war situation and we have to adjust ourselves to what this kind of war is like. And that means, you know, it means thinking, first of all. I mean, it means thinking like, well, no matter how many tanks you put on Pennsylvania Avenue, not a single tank is going to deflect an email, right? It requires thinking about the way the world actually works. I don't think that we have to continue to be vulnerable to this stuff, but we will be vulnerable to it if we don't adjust the way we see how the world works.
Well, you may be right. On the other hand, as we speak today, there is a back and forth between the Russians and Trump, which is, we don't like what's going on in Syria, so we're going to send some of our shiny, new, very good missiles their way. That's the old kind of war, isn't it? And the Russians are saying, but we'll shoot them down.
Yeah, but notice there aren't that many human beings involved. And, you know, when the U.S. did actually kill a couple hundred Russian mercenaries a few weeks ago, the Russians didn't react to it at all. I mean, I think Trump is, I don't mean to sound cynical, but I imagine that Trump is going to look for some place to explode something really big where it will make a difference one way or the other, and then we'll talk about it. I would be very surprised if Mr. Trump did something in Syria which he hadn't already cleared with the Russians. Both sides have a reason, you know, to say, like, I'm defying the other side. But I don't think Mr. Trump, I mean, given everything that, you know, we've talked about earlier about Mr. Trump's relationship with Mr. Putin, that's, I think that relationship with Mr. Putin is more important than any other relationship. It's more important than just whatever you care to name. His relationship with that foreign leader is more important than his relationship with anyone in the United States of America, as far as one can sort out. So I would imagine that what's going on is that Mr. Trump is telling Mr. Putin, look, I've got to do something or else I'll look weak. You know, what can I do which won't actually threaten you? And then they'll do something and they'll both talk about it.
Makes a lot of sense. And at least I won't get impeached. I'm sure that that enters into Trump's thinking. The name of the book is The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, America, by Professor Timothy Snyder. Tim, I want to throw you a little bit of a curveball. We've got 6 minutes left and ask you about China. How does China figure into all of this?
So China's in the background of all of this. China is the power who benefits from all of this. If you're Russia, your real geopolitical problem in traditional terms of land and resources and so on is precisely China, not the European Union, not the United States. And when Russia burns its bridges with the EU or the United States, if it succeeds in persuading them that they are actually its enemies, all it's really doing ultimately is helping China and making its own geopolitical position worse. So the Chinese in general look upon all of this with contentment.
So we think that there are no international adults in the room. Is China the adult in the room? Are there any adults other than Russia, which seems to be, according to this very good analysis, getting its way?
Yeah, it's odd. I think China, in some sense, was the adult in the room in the sense that they were the only ones looking into the future. But the way that things have gone with both with Putin and Trump, I think, has also had some kind of effect on the Chinese. It's discouraging to me, and I think also to a number of people in China, that President Xi is thinking about not having term limits and extending office indefinitely. Mm. That's a political move which, you know, could cause a great deal of instability in the medium term.
So, Tim Snyder, we've got 4 minutes left, and I wanted to ask you real quickly, what do you think the future portends? Trump is already running his re-election campaign. He may win. If he wins, how serious is that?
Alan, there's so much that's going to happen between now and 2020. I think we, even between now and November of 2018, there will be some big surprises in foreign affairs, and the various investigations will proceed, I think, to a point where Mr. Trump will have to make some kind of a decision. So, I mean, I think if Mr. Trump is still around as president, you know, a year from now, let's talk again about 2020.
But I accept.
As to threats, I mean, he shows us where things can go. And we've got to learn from that, you know, and we have to learn from it not just in the sense of disliking him or despising him, but in the sense of recognizing, like, asking what the opposite would look like. What should the local and state candidates running for office in 18 be proposing as a vision of the United States?
So when we talk about the 2018 elections at this moment in the day and see the possibility that the House, at least the House, will go Democratic. We see Republicans bailing out. Today we heard of Mr. Ryan, the Speaker, bailing out. What will that do to the basic thesis of your book about the Russians having their way with us?
Well, they certainly it's a very significant victory to have brought the president, to have brought Mr. Trump to the office of the presidency, regardless of what happens next. And I think their ultimate goal was to make us weaker in international affairs, which we certainly have been, and it's going to be a long time before we recover. You know, our moral reputation will take generations, I think, to recover after just the last couple of years. And the final thing I would say is that it's not that the Russians are geniuses and always get their way. I mean, their only tactic is disintegration, right? That's the only thing they've got, and they're ultimately that's all they've got. And when that's your only tactic, you're taking the risk that the other side might say, as I hope we do, that disintegration shows how we should pick up the pieces and how we can put ourselves together in a way which is better than we were before. That's the risk that the Russians are taking. I don't think they understand that risk because I think deep down they don't really believe in the rule of law. They don't really believe in civil society, so it's hard to see them in the United States. But I think that this could be a wake-up call and that we might turn things around. So the point of the book is not that Russia always wins. The point of the book is that Russia won in this surprisingly important way because of trends in technology, because of their own strategy, which I try to explain, and because of our own vulnerabilities in Europe and in the U.S.
And last question, we have a minute left. Are you optimistic, pessimistic?
I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic. I mean, part of the point of the book is that history is much more open than we think it is, especially in moments like this. The whole point of the book actually is to like create a kind of historical panorama so that you see yourself where you're standing. So I'm neither optimistic nor pessimistic by nature. I'm full of hope when I see what some Americans are doing and how some young Americans are reacting and thinking about all of this. But I think it's still very much up to us. This is a day-by-day effort, and there's no magic thing which comes in from the wings which is going to make us win or make us lose.
We've been talking with Yale professor Timothy Snyder about his latest book, The Road to Unfreedom, Russia, Europe, and America. Tim, I can't tell you how honored we are to have you with us. I'm Alan Chartart. Professor Snyder, again, thanks so much for joining us today.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you very much, Alan.
You've been listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series, or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store. Thank you.